The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We have a several-part show for you today. A little later in the program, we're going to hear from Tariq Ali, author of the book The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power. He's an incredible thinker that we're going to be joined by to hear his thoughts as he joins us from London, England. But in a minute, we'll be talking to Paige Croyder, and I'll introduce her in a minute. But first, I want to tell you something. That the voice of the community, that means your WEAA, needs your support right now to make a huge difference in this community. We want you to join us for the WEAA Community Cares Holiday Drive. It's taking place all day. It ends at 6 p.m. tonight, which is the end of my show. So don't wait. Listen to the show. Come down here right now, outside of our studios at Morgan State University's new communications building. And we welcome you. We welcome to come and help support Be Gaddy. We are going to welcome new or gently used clothes, brand new children's toys, non-perishable food, and our collections will all go to the Be Gaddy Family Center. And it's very important to give back to WEAA, to your community, to support people in this holiday season. Be Gaddy was a real champion of our community. She worked for the homeless. She's dedicated her life to the homeless. And WEAA Community Cares has profiled many champions in our community over the years. And you can share with us how important it is now more than ever to give. So the power of DWEA is our listeners, you. So today during our drive, we've had countless people drop off clothing, non-perishable food items, and all these items will make a real difference in a lot of lives in this community. So it's your most important, powerful moment of giving here at WEAA. Again, we're outside of our studios at Morgan State University's new communications building on Perrin Parkway. We have radio personalities downstairs, talk show hosts there to greet you, to join you in conversation, waiting for your donation. So remember, together we can all make a huge difference for our community. Only on public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We care, you care, we will all help Be Gaddy's Family Center, so join us. Only got to 6 o'clock, so hurry on down. Now, before we go to the Tariq Ali, we are joined by Paige Croyder, who is a former assistant U.S. attorney.
State's attorney,
here in Baltimore City. Pardon me. I made her a federal employee when she was not. She won Best of Baltimore for her blog that appears on our website. It's thesteinershow.com, which you can read. And it causes a lot of controversy, positive and negative, people loving it and really just caused a lot of people to think. She's a regular contributor to us here on the CM blog. You hear on other radio stations as well. She wrote a blog the other day that I responded to very quickly that created a heated discussion between Paige Croyder and myself. And we're bringing it to the airwaves to discuss the reform of our criminal justice system. And we want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk with Paige Croyder. You often ruffle feathers, but it seems like we ruffled each other's feathers here in this last go-around. Let's talk a bit about what you kind of took umbrage at, which was the perception of kind of a lock-em-up, throw-away-the-key attitude, I guess, that you thought I was accusing you of.
Well, that's what the article sounded like. But originally I had written Murder Media and the Maddening Cycle.
Right.
And I was talking about McGainey, the young man who was arrested in connection with the murder of Ken Harris. And I was pointing out how in a particular instance in his criminal career, the city of Baltimore could have done something. And I specifically said that you couldn't accuse the city state's attorney of being responsible for Harris's murder, but that they could have done something to change his trajectory or slow him down, and they didn't. And I felt that it was part of the pattern that I have been writing about persistently, which is the failure of the criminal justice system to focus on the persons who pose the most danger to society. It's been my experience that they tend to treat pretty much everybody the same. And the point that I've been trying to drive home is that we must distinguish between them, and then we must focus our resources on those who pose the greatest dangers. I have not said that we should lock them all up without a second thought. I don't believe in playing blame games for the sake of you know, and I don't know what you meant by that, but what I mean by that is sort of a counterproductive looking for somebody to blame for everything that happens. What I'm trying to do is change the thinking, the dynamics of the criminal justice system by advocating the way that I do for figuring out who's dangerous and then focusing our resources on them.
And I guess what visually hit me about some of the things and why I kind of responded that way and what I've been writing about since, but I haven't posted yet, is that we don't have a system that does anything but take people off the street if we don't want them there and lock them up. Oftentimes, we have people who are arrested, stay in jail for months at a time in city jail, only to be exonerated, adjudicated, or set free or not charged after they're there. We have a system that may give people probation or put them out on bail, but there is no system of pretrial intervention of any seriousness that goes into people's lives to change lives. We have a system that locks more people up than any other Western nation, or any other nation on the planet Earth, with very few positive results. And we're afraid to tackle what it means to really reform that system. So I always kind of wonder what is expected of judges and juries and state's attorneys, public defenders, whoever involved in the process, when we have a system that is completely broken. And it's not just broken from the state's attorney's end, it's broken, period.
Well, you have to tell us why it's broken. I mean, to say that there are no services, for example, I see plenty of people sentenced to drug treatment. There are in-house programs. There are, walk-in-the-street type programs. There are anger management that people are sentenced to. There is pretrial supervision programs. We all have to be careful about talking in these broad terms that there's none of this or there's none of that. And we have to start really taking a look at what resources we do have and how we're using them. But what I am saying is that there is a population that needs to be locked up, and we don't. And I don't even think it's that difficult to identify a lot of them. I have talked about a number of them in my articles. One of them, who's going to trial this month, is a perfect example. His name is DeJuan Carter. He he's accused of murdering, let's just go through his record and see where the system went wrong. And I don't think it's because there was a failure to give him a chance to straighten himself out. I think it was a failure to say, this is a dangerous person, and we're not going to lock him up. Okay, he's arrested at age 16. He's got a gun right off the bat. When you see these juvenile records, you have to take notice. This is a young person who is already breaking the law. This is somebody we have to keep our eye on. He gets put on probation as an adult for that. He's then arrested two more times within a year for dealing drugs. He was arrested two more times, once for drugs and once for felony assault. He was handled as a juvenile. Nothing happened to his handgun probation that he was put on for his handgun case. He then is arrested for two drug dealing cases as an adult after he turns 18 years old. The system does not incarcerate him. It gives him, continues his probation for his handgun, and gives him two more probations for his two drug cases. Now he's arrested again for drug dealing, and finally, he gets 5 years. He does less than 21 months on a 5-year sentence because the parole commissioners decided that he was a good candidate for parole. He comes out on parole, and he's arrested for carrying a handgun. Now, at this point, my unit, when I was in the state's attorney's office, was involved, and we said, this guy needs a no bail. I mean, he's had a gun before, three times now for dealing drugs. He's on parole. He's got another gun. Keep him off the street. Bail commissioner and the judge said no. He posted bail, and he's arrested for murder. I mean, I don't think that should come as a surprise to anybody. And it can't say that the prison turned him into a monster. I mean, he didn't only 21 months. If we look at McGainey, who I wrote about, McGainey didn't serve any jail time. And he's arrested for killing Ken Harris. What did he have? A gun. And he had drugs in his possession that indicated he was drug dealing. These are the two, the youth, the drug dealing, and the guns. These are the things that jumped out at me when I did the war room.
And I guess what I would say in response to that, whoops, this chair is a little broken, I'm sorry, but is that when you read this kid's arrest record when he was 16, I mean, we have nothing in this system. When I say nothing, let me explain what I mean. Our programs are scattered. There is no concerted effort or investment in a large way in programs in this community or in most communities in America that address kids who are 16 years old and arrested for the first time. They don't exist. There are no programs that involve therapy, work, education, family counseling, turning kids around, grabbing hold of them. We don't do that. We either arrest them, put them in jail. If we don't put them in jail, we put them in probation with no supervision for any serious change. So, I mean, that to me is where the system is broken. The system isn't broken because we don't put enough people in jail. The system is broken because we do not make the effort to deal with first and second time offenders in creative, meaningful ways. And there aren't enough drug treatment beds in this city. There never have been, and there still aren't. People get turned away all the time and told, we don't have room for you at this moment. There are no homeless shelters in this town for women and children. I mean, there are a few beds, let me say, for women and children in this town who are homeless. I mean, we have an ability to spend millions and millions of dollars to lock people up, but no money to reform the system or to deal with people who get in trouble with the law in the beginning. And so and there are bad actors. Look, I spend time working in the state prisons. I grew up in part of a neighborhood as a kid where I knew a lot of guys who just should never see the light of day. I knew a lot of guys in the prison who were there for robbery who I think should probably have never walked out of the prison gates because they were just so torn as human beings when they got out, they were going to be just who they were, if not worse. But the reality is, you can't keep people in prison forever, and we have no system to deal with the people you're talking about in a way that it ensures that, not ensures, but can go towards ensuring us that they may be reformed and reform themselves.
Well, I can't, first of all, I've never taken the position that I am against any of those programs. I absolutely think, and I've said it multiple times, I've said that we need to interview. I brought the number of my articles here that have said, first of all, law enforcement can't fix the problem of crime by itself. We need an overarching plan, and a plan that includes especially intervention with the young. I mean, once they become criminals, it's very difficult to go down that rehabilitation path. From what I see, you see less violence simply because they've gotten older, because they've gotten into their 40s and their 50s. But the young people, expecting them to rehabilitate once they've gotten used to a life of violence, I don't know what programs work for them. I do think that intervention at the youth level is something we absolutely want and should be part of a plan. But that's not what I'm addressing. I'm addressing what does the law enforcement community do when you have a DeJuan Carter who's now in front of you, okay? He was 16 years old. You didn't do anything to him in the criminal justice system. Can you try to intervene early? Sure. I am not an expert in the juvenile system. So I don't know what he was offered when he was arrested for felony assault, when he was arrested for drug dealing. I do know that they do try to work with the youth, but I can't speak to that. But I'm saying now we have him as an adult. We have him multiple times as an adult. We are compelled at this point to lock him up, and we don't, and that he murdered. And it was predictable. The young person, Brandon Grimes, who was arrested for killing the off-duty police officer, Troy Chesley, I'm still shocked that he was on the street. He had a handgun, he was on bail for that, and he gets arrested for another handgun violation. Regardless of what did or did not happen to him prior in his life, you know, whether he was beaten, whether he needs psychological services, whatever has turned him into a gun-toting criminal, that's what he's doing now. And yet we didn't revoke his bail. And he was on the street and killed in a robbery attempt, Troy Chesley. So I'm not at odds with you. What I'm saying is that when we have a person who has now built up a resume, we are not handling them appropriately. I am all for trying to intervene, and we're not going to change the culture until we do. We can you know, we can lock everybody up and there's going to be more behind them unless there's a change in the underlying culture. And by the way, I don't think we should lock everybody up. I mean, my most recent piece, I said I think we need to try a new approach for drug addicts because our prisons have exploded because of people for possession of drugs or filling them up. And I believe that that's counterproductive. Our focus should be on the violent.
Paige Corder is with us. She is a regular blogger on our website. She's won the Best of Baltimore for that blog. She's a former assistant state's attorney. Her blog has gotten a lot of hits. It's caused a lot of controversy and has gained a lot of support at the same time. Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Donnie in West Baltimore, you're on the air.
Donnie Glover, Mark, how you doing?
Hey, Donnie, how are you?
I'm good. I'm listening to Paige Corder, and as a black man, the first thing that comes to my mind is that 44% of America's prisons are black males. When you consider that disproportionate number and you consider the approach that Paige is taking, the, you know, that more that those violent people need to be arrested, I just get the impression that she has a lack of understanding of the whole situation. When you look around the urban community, you look at LaMel, it is not unusual, even when I went there in 77 to 79, for young people to have guns. You have a school that you're attracting youth from different neighborhoods, and today it's even more marked by gangs. I don't think she really understands the impact that lead paint has had on the city of Baltimore. And I'm not hearing her advocate for a much improved public education system and a recreation system. Because if you don't give the young people something to do, she's absolutely right. There are more to come. But I'm not sure she really understands all of the dynamics involved in why young people are committing acts. Ken Harris was a very dear friend of mine, and I'm very glad that they caught the person. But the truth of the matter is, our young people are only imitating what they see. This is a violent culture, a violent society, let alone from war in Iraq to Afghanistan to the streets of Baltimore. So I think she needs to advocate also for some public education, much more spending on that, and a better understanding, including lead paint and the broken families. If 44% of America's prisons are black males, then there are a lot of broken or at least fractured black families out here. And I think that's the primary demographic.
Don, it's good to hear from you. I look forward to getting on my show soon.
Yes, sir.
Miss talking to you.
Yes, sir.
Paige Corder.
You're looking for my response?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm aware of the disproportion in the prisons. It's something I've been reading about. And what I've learned in my reading is this, is that it appears that black drug users are disproportionately imprisoned over white drug users. Now, I'm talking about simply drug users. And there's a disproportionate imprisoning of the black population over the white population when it comes to drug usage. When it comes to violent crimes, there's also a disproportionate imprisonment. However, there is a disproportionate amount of black violence on black violence. In other words, that's accurately reflecting a disproportionate the fact that a lot of black men are locked up for violent crimes accurately reflects the proportion at which those crimes are being committed. There is a violent culture in the cities that has caught up a lot of the black men. When it comes to simply drug usage, black drug users are disproportionately imprisoned compared to their ratio to the white drug users.
But when we have a society where the majority of people in prison are not in prison for violent crimes. They're in prison for property crimes. They're in prison for all kinds of nonviolent crimes, many associated with drug use. And now, I don't have the studies in front of me, but there are a lot of studies that show the disproportionate sentences given to, disproportionately high sentences given to blacks as opposed to lower sentences for similar crimes, even serious crimes, given to whites in America. And, well, and all that's real. So, I mean, what Anthony's saying is that we're locking up more African-American men and in some places Puerto Rican men, and in some places out west Native American men, then we are white men for very similar crimes.
Well, again, I'm not here as a criminologist to discuss the proportions. And I disagree with him when he says that I don't have an understanding of where a lot of this comes from. But what I am saying is that people with guns and people who are dealing drugs are the ones that are doing the killing in the community. I am all for, and when he says I haven't advocated, again, I can go back into my pieces and say that I do advocate for programs, especially for the youth, that address the issues that they face. I totally understand that. But I can't sit by and say, but you can shoot and you can shoot and you can shoot. You know, if you're going to go out there with a gun, if you're going to be selling drugs, if you're going to be involved in that culture, and I haven't even said to lock them up forever on their first offense. What I have said is they have to be monitored and they should be monitored closely.
And I don't think anybody would disagree that gun use is jail time, or maybe you do. 410-319-8888. Dennis in Baltimore, you've been waiting on a while. You're on the air.
To both of you, I've had a chance to hear both of you and read a lot of what you both have written, and I think it's a dialogue that needs to continue, especially in this location that we're in. I guess my question is more from a cynical standpoint, and that would be, how can we even really start to have a conversation of effective, you know, criminal, you know, justice and crime prevention when we don't factor in the issues of the juries here in the city? I think that it's fair to say that a lot of juries in the city are not prone to convicting those who, on the most apparent levels, are guilty. And we've had judges that have even said that. I know many months ago, I think John Glenn said that, you know, people in this city simply don't convict to take care of the guilty. And there was even a controversial study that I'm sure you're both quite familiar with through the Able Foundation.
Yes.
That said the exact same thing. So I guess my point is that a lot of this stuff, a lot of this prevention is, to me at least, is not so important as it is, as is putting in a structure in place that will make it clear to these that are committing crimes that if you commit these crimes, you will go to jail. And I think that's a cultural issue that really needs to be factored in more, and I just am not seeing it happen. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, though.
I wrote one of my blogs is called What Baltimore Wants, and it describes a case where citizens called police because they saw a person sitting on some steps with a gun at his feet. And the police showed up and arrested him and took his gun in, and he went to a jury, and that was the evidence, just what I told you. There was no contradicting evidence. And the jury acquitted the defendant. And it is what we see in Baltimore. The study by the Able Foundation confirmed what everybody knows, that Baltimore City juries, first of all, they distrust the police. So when it depends on a police testimony alone, they tend to be more skeptical. But also, this was a particular case where you can't even say they didn't believe he was in possession of a gun. What they did is they sent him a note saying that he'd gotten a break and they hoped he used this opportunity to turn his life around. Of course, they didn't know that he was on probation for a crime. And after they let him go, he went on to be arrested again. So the problem that you point out is real. It is not, however, insurmountable. One of the things that I have been quite critical when I was in the state's attorney's office of my own office was the failure to be creative. If this is a jurisdiction, a city, where most people, if they're caught with a gun, are going to be put on probation for the first time, why aren't we doing a better job of supervising them? We don't. What we do is we wait for them to commit another crime. They're put on probation and they're told you must look for work, or you must go back to school, or you must be doing something productive. And essentially, they ignore every rule of probation except sometimes, you know, if they report sometimes, that's okay, except committing another crime. And so we're not supervising them. But if we were, that would be another way to take some of them off the street, even though we don't have a jury, you know, convicting. If you're on probation because he pled guilty, you have a tool to manage this criminal if you're willing to take advantage of it.
Now, that's precisely my point, though, that I think the problem is if somebody's put on probation for, let's say, carrying a gun, first-time offender. People carry guns for all kinds of reasons in communities, sometimes just to protect themselves, not to commit crimes. If that happens, if they're put on probation, the problem is there is no program. You have probation. People go to probation offices. They sit down in front of a probation officer. They have a conversation. Nothing really takes place. They report in. There's nothing that is involved in these programs that actively tries to change behavior.
Well, again,
that's part of the problem.
Well, you're addressing, again, an issue on which I am not an expert. But let me just say this. I don't think that's exactly true. I think there are plenty of probation agents who are working with their population. They're talking to them about work. They're making referrals to work. It's not like, you and me and say, okay, you've been here today at 2 o'clock, see you next month. You know, there's more conversation and there's more attempts to refer and to give advice and monitor than that.
But every probation officer you talk to will say that we can't do the work we want to do with people who are sent to us because the caseloads are too big.
I agree with that.
And we cannot effectively deal with the people who are sent to us.
I agree with that, and that's why I think that we need to have a whole new approach to dealing with the nonviolent. We're not going to be able to use the resources for the violent as long as we over and over again are putting the drug addicts and the prostitutes on probation, violating them, giving them a nominal sentence, and having them arrested over and over again. I think that is counterproductive, and that's where we need to be the most creative.
410-319-8888. Join us here as we talk with Paige Croyder for this part of the show. Looking forward to having her be a regular part of debates and discussions on the air here with me and with others about how we reform our criminal justice system. Dolores, on the road, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Dolores. You're on the road.
Hello,
air.
Okay.
We know you're on the road, but you're on the air.
Yes. I have a concern about the apparently availability of all these guns on the street. There's so many of them. They seem to have no problem getting these guns. Like they're just being harvested at yards or something. Why is it we don't hear anything about these guns and how they get into our neighborhoods?
That's a very serious question. I mean, you can pick up this page, but I mean, one of the things I've learned from police and other people who deal with this issue, and from the U.S. attorney, who was on the show just a few weeks ago, is that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of guns in this city stashed away in vacant houses and all kinds of places that are readily available and sold all the time. I mean, that's a big part of what's going on. To get to this, that source is something very hard to do. Or they have not been able to do, I should say.
Well, I know that one of the mandates of the specialized unit of the state's attorney's office, they call it the 5-unit, Firearms Violence Enforcement Unit. One of the things they were supposed to do is go after gun traffickers. But I think when it comes down to it is that this is a culture that has not rejected the gun culture. I mean, as a culture, Americans are a gun-toting community. And, you know, people have them in their houses and they get stolen. People can go into the store, they can buy them. They can go to gun stores and they can buy them. And they are particularly going to proliferate in a community where people want to use them, and they get used. They get used for, you know, in drug wars and gang wars, and they are easily accessible. And until I think we as a culture decide we don't want them, we're going to have them.
Paige Croyder's with us, former state's attorney, Best of Baltimore winner for her blog that appears on our website, 410-319-8888. Mike in Ellicott City, you're on the air.
Good evening, folks. Your discussion reminds me of a song, a rhythm and blues song from the 1960s. Now, out of respect for Mark and his guest, I will not attempt to sing it.
That's good. Thank you.
I will, however, state the lyric.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing from nothing is nothing. I'm a victim in the war on poverty. You guys are not being real if you think we can deal with urban street crime without dealing with concentrated urban poverty. If you don't want to deal with that problem, as serious as you may be in your heart, practically speaking, you're not serious. Concentrated poverty, street crime, functional illiteracy, these phenomena are inseparable. And the core of it is the concentrated urban poverty. Our kids, there was some this statewide test the kids got to take, 3% passed math, 8% past English, and these tests are trivial. It's an expression of the actual existence that people undergo, and there is no program that could teach me people as a culture, quote unquote, to live in poverty. It doesn't work, and you've got to deal with it.
I guess, Paige Smith, we only have a few minutes left, so I know you have to go, and we're going to play another segment, and we'll have Paige back very soon because the phones are lighting up. People do want to tackle this subject, and I think it's a really important one for all of our communities in this metropolitan area and in the state. But that's one of the things I think that people kind of – I guess, you know, if we talked about earlier how we started this, and in terms of what you and I have been writing back and forth on the blog, is that when we criticize the failure of the district, the state's attorney, others to do their job, it seems to me that what's missing, then every time that's raised, the issues that Mike or Carla just raised have to be raised because it's in the context of the reality we face, not just in the reality of what we have to deal with the violence and crime.
I think you have to understand where I'm coming from, okay? I agree that all those issues are a problem. Here's a sentence from one of my articles. I will continue to talk about the parts of the criminal justice system that can be improved, but we citizens must remember that while law enforcement plays a role in public safety, our overall community, home, education, and work plays the bigger role. So when I say that the criminal justice system could have done this, you can't say, well, we can't talk about that because we haven't talked about poverty or we haven't talked about education or we haven't talked about employment. We have to talk about all of these things together.
We've been talking with Paige Croiter, who will join us once again, and all of you can call back then and we take part in this conversation. We're going to continue. Reforming criminal justice will be a big part of the Mark Steiner Show. Paige Croiter can be read on our blog. And I thank you so much for taking the time, Paige. We'll talk to you really soon again.
Thank you.
And we're going to go to a little break here, and you're going to listen to a piece that we produced for the Maryland Humanities Council on the life of Rosa Parks, one of the great civil rights heroes during this week that is Rosa Parks Day on December 1st. And then we'll have a conversation with Tariq Ali, who wrote the book The Duel, Pakistan, on the flight path of American power. Stay with us. Don't go away.
Like a motherless child,
I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're going to talk for a bit here with Tariq Ali, who is a noted writer, journalist, filmmaker, social and political thinker, who was born in Pakistan, educated in Britain, lives there now. He's campaigned for a just society for decades against wars, Vietnam, now Iraq. He's written many works of fiction. He's written many other works as well, like Can Pakistan Survive, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Bush and Babylon, some of my favorites, his fiction books like Shadows of Pomegranate Tree and The Stone Woman. And he's written a new book, and it's called The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power. And we're going to talk with him briefly today about that book, but also about what's going on at the moment in Pakistan, in India, in Afghanistan, and this new American government coming in and what it all means for all of us. And Tariq Ali, it's a pleasure to have you on the air with us once again.
Very good to be with you again, Mark.
So let me begin. I mean, you wrote a piece the other day about Mumbai and what happened there. And I was reading a piece you wrote about right after the election here in the United States of America that elected Barack Obama as the next president of the United States. And I was in the middle of those two things. I was reading your book, The Duel. And I couldn't help but think that we are now in a situation that brings to the fore some of the conclusions you reach in The Duel about American policy in Pakistan. And I'd like to know what you think the future portends when you look at this new presidency of Barack Obama, this security team he's put in place, what's just happened in Mumbai, and the complexities of his approach to Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, if we start with Barack Obama's victory, Mark, and what he said during the election campaign on Afghanistan, we can only be depressed because he was to the right of both McCain and his former rival Hillary Clinton in terms of escalating the war in Afghanistan. But I hope sense will prevail because some of his advisors are intelligent human beings, and they will tell him that this is a war that can no longer be won, as the British, the Germans, and the Spanish now, amongst the European allies, are more or less saying publicly. The slightly disappointing thing here, Mark, is that all these retreads that Obama has hired to run his government. I mean, Hillary Clinton, I'm told, is bringing in Richard Holbrooke, well-known hawk. Other people, tried and tested hawks during the Clinton administration, are going to be back. So let us hope that Obama can overrule them. And he's just not going to be a president who gives too much power to the people he's appointed. But certainly, as far as Afghanistan is concerned, the United States has to prepare an exit strategy, and rapidly. Because if they don't do it, and if they carry on the way they are, it is going to destabilize Pakistan with, you know, unforeseen consequences. If the Pakistani military splits, as I argue in my book, then all bets are off. We don't know what could happen. Add to that what we've seen in Mumbai. Now, if you read my piece in Counterpunch, I mean, what I argued was that this had all the signs of a homegrown business. Since I wrote that piece, we have seen interviews with the terrorists who carried out this attack on Indian television, explaining why they carried it out and in local accents. And when one of the terrorists, Imran Babar, was asked by an Indian television journalist, "Where are you from?" he got angry. They were speaking in a mixture of Urdu and Hindi. He said, "What do you mean, where are we from? We are from here. We know what's been happening to our people in this country. We know what is going on in Kashmir." And so the angry interviewer said, "And so you're killing innocents. Is that why?" And he said, "Well, you know, we don't mean to kill innocents. But when our innocents are killed, why don't you get angry then? All the innocents who've died in Kashmir, who've died in Gujarat, who've died in other bomb attacks on our people, you never complained then. Why has this become so special?" So the interviewer then says, "Well, why have you attacked this Jewish house in Bombay? What has that got to do with anything?" And the terrorist replies, "You seem to be unaware that an Israeli general visited Kashmir to give the Indian government advice on how to repress the Kashmiri people." So suddenly, I began to realize that what I'd said instinctively was now turning out to be true, that it appears that the bulk of the people involved were people, local Muslims in India, who'd finally had too much, had lost faith in the political system, and every wing of it, right, center, left, and had embarked on terrorism. It's a terrible tragedy. But Obama needs to do something, not just about Afghanistan, but I think on Kashmir as well, putting real pressure on the Indians to allow the Kashmiri people some semblance of self-rule. The situation in Kashmir is much, much worse than Tibet, which gets people agitated. But many, many more Kashmiris have died, been tortured, been raped than Tibetans. So something needs to be done here, and this is why the world is waiting till January the 20th, when he's inaugurated, so to see what the new president and his team are going to do.
I wonder what your analysis is about what you think is happening, not just if you take what is going on in India now, the attacks in Mumbai, but you can take what happens in India now and move it to many regions and nations in the world. In terms of the ethnic divide and religious divides and the anger that erupts into terrorism, why do you think it's taking place at this point in the 21st century?
I think the reason anger takes the form of terrorism, Mark, is that large numbers of young people have given up hope. They have said that this system doesn't do anything for us. I mean, if we were in the 60s and 70s, the form radicalization would have taken would have been for young black kids to join the black power groups, the Black Panthers, become supporters of Malcolm X, and for people in other parts of the world to move towards communism, to move towards radical socialist politics. These politics are now not on offer because they've been defeated in the 80s and 90s. So people turn to what's available. And in India and South Asia, what's available both for Hindu fundamentalists and for Muslim fundamentalists is religion. So they move in that direction. The only continent where this isn't happening is Latin America, where you have the Bolivarian leaders in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Paraguay, who move towards sort of some form of radical social democratic New Deal type solutions. But leaving that continent aside, elsewhere in the world, you either have ethnic hatreds which have developed as a result of competition for food, for land, for water, as we've seen in, as we are witnessing in Darfur and the Congo, or you have what we are witnessing in India, which is a huge country, you know, with 1.5 billion people almost.
Mm-hmm.
And this country is predominantly Hindu. The bulk of the terrorist attacks that have taken place this year in India have been carried out by Hindu fundamentalists, including a serving officer in the Indian Army who's been arrested on charges of bombing civilian installations and a friendship train between India and Pakistan. So the Mumbai attack mustn't be decontextualized and seen as something special. It's part of what has been going on in India now for the last 10 years. And it's very clear to me that the extreme right-wing party, the BJP, is now going to use this event to try and come back to power in the next elections.
So what do you think, when you look at the expanse, if you've done in this book and some other books, things you've written, of American policy towards Pakistan from 1948 to 2008, what changes? How does any Western capitalist nation change its policy to address the issues you're outlining?
Well, I think that U.S. policies towards Pakistan, as I outline in the duel Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power, have been largely instrumentalist. Pakistan has been used by successive U.S. governments to do their bidding. A military coup in 1958 to put the army in power when they were frightened that parties opposed to Pakistan's membership of U.S. security pacts might come to power. Agreeing that the military should topple Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, Benazir's father, in 1977 because Kissinger was fearful that he was going to develop the atomic bomb. And on that, of course, Kissinger was right. Bhutto said he was going to do it, though he told the U.S. he wasn't, and Kissinger told him, we're going to make a horrible example out of you. So Bhutto was removed, the country's first elected prime minister, and hanged by a military dictator. A military dictator, the worst Pakistan has ever known, who was then given solid backing by the West, and then when the Russians entered Afghanistan stupidly, as they did, this military dictator became the center of the free world, we were told. And all these right-wing extremist religious groups that were created in Pakistan were created by the state from the top with Western backing. Now we need a non-religious military dictator to try and secularize the country. So we had General Musharraf. So, you know, the joke I make, I don't know whether I put it in this book or not, but I certainly do it when I'm lecturing, that if the United States needed a hermaphrodite as commander-in-chief and chief of staff of the Pakistan Army, the generals would waste no time in finding it. I mean, the country has been used by the U.S. continuously, and it is still being used. And now they've given the green light to the most corrupt civilian the country has seen in a long, long time, and that's saying hell of a lot in the case of Pakistan, Benazir's widower, Asif Zardari, who's the most corrupt man, a rogue, a thief, not very intelligent, semi-literate. This guy is the president of the country. I mean, he can't, you know, string two sentences together. The only time I've seen him coming to life recently, Mark, was when he was attending the UN session in New York before the elections and ran into Sarah Palin. And he began to drool, and he actually said, "My God, you're gorgeous." A verdict with which the American electorate happily did not concur. But this is the president of Pakistan. So we've got a very weak, corrupt civilian president and who the United States is using at the moment, a disaffected military, disaffected because of the U.S. attacks inside Pakistan, which they have to support because they are loyal allies. And so it's a critical situation. And then we have these Mumbai attacks, which the Indians say are Pakistanis, but which the evidence points to in the opposite direction.
So, Tariq Ali, the question then in my mind, there's a couple of them here I really want to explore before, while we have time to talk about it on this program, is, so A, what happens to Pakistan with now with a very weak government, with you know, rebellions in Balochistan and what's going on in the territories in the north and all the rest, and how this stabilized? You said a moment ago, and in your book you talk about the potential of the Pakistani army splitting. Yesterday we had guests talking about that the Pakistani army was the most powerful stabilizing force in Pakistan. So there's a contradiction here.
Well, I mean, I think your guest was being slightly bland, because though the military has remained united, the war in Afghanistan, which has begun to spill over into Pakistan, and the fact that CENTCOM directly pays the invoices of the Pakistani military has meant that a lot of young officers are very disaffected. Look, this army was told from the 80s onwards, your main enemy is the Hindu. Now, this was grotesque, but that is what they were told. Your enemy is the Hindu, our enemy is India. And we must be permanently on guard. No one told the soldiers and junior officers that our enemy might be Muslims one day. So when these kids are sent in to the Afghan border to kill their own people, naturally some of them rebel because they're totally taken by surprise. There are lots and lots of cases of soldiers just surrendering to a handful of guerrillas who haven't even fired on them, but just lifting their arms and saying, we won't fire on you. There are cases, I think, I don't have the exact figures because they haven't been supplied, because these statistics aren't preserved, of lots of junior officers refusing to go on a second tour of duty to the Afghan-Pakistan border regions and instead taking early retirement. We have cases of soldiers refusing to fight because 60 mullahs decreed a fatwa against anyone who killed another Muslim. So it's a crazy situation, and the United States, I think, has to, till it develops an exit strategy from the region, I think this is going to carry on.
So let me, if you could outline for a moment, when you talk about the analysis of 40 years of America's policy towards Pakistan, using Pakistan as a state, a foil for American policies, then what would be an analysis about where America needs to go and what the argument should be in America about policies towards Pakistan and then Afghanistan?
Well, I think in terms of Afghanistan, they have to prepare an exit strategy to leave the country and involve the neighboring countries to come in and create a stable national coalition government in Afghanistan. They shouldn't do what they did in the past, which is hand the country to the Pakistani military intelligence. We need the involvement of Pakistan, India, Iran, and Russia, the key players in this region, to come and help set up a national coalition government, which the Chinese can then be brought in to create an economic infrastructure to stabilize a country which has been at war now for 30 years, Mark. A longer war than the First World War, a longer war than the Second World War, longer than the U.S. war in Vietnam. That is what Afghanistan is, and it's a complete mess. And the NATO forces have made it worse. So I think a planned, effective exit strategy, which hands over the political leadership in the region to the region, would be worthwhile. As far as Pakistan is concerned, what are the key needs of Pakistan? The key needs are education, to educate its people. This is a country approaching 200 million, to create an education system. The state has failed to create it, but there are lots of people in the country desperate to be educated. We need a health service. There are more Pakistani doctors in the United States than there are in Pakistan. So it's not that Pakistan doesn't have the possibility of producing people to service its needs and the needs of the majority. It's just that this corrupt and venal elite, which has been in power, either military or political, has basically refused to do anything that has taken the country forward or to modernize the country. And we are now in a desperate situation. And the U.S. has to understand that and to pull back. And all they need to say to the elite is, we're not speaking to you, we're not giving you a cent or a dollar of our money till we see a proper education system in place. If you're not going to put it in place, then we're going to approach UNESCO and raise funds for UNESCO to create 6 large teachers training colleges in Pakistan to train ordinary or educated Pakistanis how to teach, because this is a skill which no longer exists in the country. If you were to go into a school and hear how teachers teach, with the best will in the world, they do it, but it's really sad and pathetic. I have heard it. So these are the needs of the country, and once you begin to do that, then gradually the appeal, which is limited anyway, of the jihadi terrorists will begin to fade.
I wonder in these kind of discussions, you know, I was listening to what you were describing a moment in this conversation about what America should do in terms of its foreign policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan. And what you describe is, on one level, very complex and long range, and countries are more often to opt for simplistic, quick solutions that also fit their needs on other levels. I mean, this is a very difficult bridge for most Western nations, especially America, I think, to bridge.
It is, but I think we need an American president who is capable of looking ahead. He may be in power for 4 or 8 years, but he has to look ahead at least 20 years, because that's when his legacy will be judged. You know, people still talk about Roosevelt's New Deal. They still talk about it as the only example of domestic American politics when the needs of the people were served to a certain extent. And if there was a president who was capable of doing this in crucial areas where American foreign policy till now has been a disaster, this president will be remembered. So it's not that it can't be done. There are no quick fixes in Pakistan, Mark. Let me tell you that. We need a medium-term strategy to turn the country around. The only quick fix we can have is a NATO withdrawal from Afghanistan, but that, too, has to be handled properly.
Tariq Ali, it's always a pleasure to speak to you, and I thank you so much for taking your time with us. And we look forward to talking to you again very soon, I hope.
Very good to be with you, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tariq Ali has been our guest. He wrote the book, The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight of American Power. Noted international social and political thinker, journalist, and filmmaker. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We engineered this hour by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Stavros Halkias, Charles Harris, and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, to podcast any of our past shows and additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.